KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
And it's not like eggs that we can complain about it, but we can still afford it. I mean, this becomes just not affordable for people to even try to buy.
President Trump says he'll impose a 25% tax on all imported cars and car parts. What does this mean for car shoppers?
For Thursday, March 27th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, how the war between Russia and Ukraine is largely being fought with drones.
Ukraine is at the cutting edge, but Russia is not far behind.
Once you've got a technology, other side tries to counter, and then you have to find another solution. It's a constant war.
Also, after fires destroyed the only mosque in Altadena, how the community is marking Ramadan.
And a renowned conductor prepares for his final concerts.
It's also a miracle that Michael has survived this cancer. And, you know, is still getting up on stage and performing.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Department of Health and Human Services has become the latest large federal government agency to feel the jobs-cutting axe as part of the Trump administration's government downsizing. HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announcing today a combination of early buyouts and layoffs will result in the elimination of 20,000 jobs. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has more.
When President Trump came into office, there were 82,000 employees across all of HHS. Secretary Kennedy says many employees have already left or been fired, and with all of that, plus the jobs they're going to eliminate with this new restructuring plan, they would end up with 62,000 employees. That is a 25% reduction.
The Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention would be among the hardest hit. Kennedy says the agency will do more with less. President Trump's plans to impose 25% tariffs on all imported cars could weigh less heavily on EV maker Tesla than many other manufacturers. NPR's Scott Newman has more.
The new tariffs are set to kick in starting in April. That's bad news for foreign car makers. But for Tesla, with assembly plants in Texas and California, the impact may not be as great as for others. Even so, foreign-made auto parts are also on the tariff list, and about 30 to 40% of Teslas use components made abroad. That's still less than for many of the company's competitors in the electric vehicle market. Tesla has seen its sales slump and its cars in showrooms vandalized in recent months amid consumer anger over CEO Elon Musk's role in slashing and dismantling government agencies. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has withdrawn his long-running nominee to be the ambassador to the United Nations. NPR's Claudio Grisales reports with the GOP's tight margin in the House, Republicans could not afford to lose New York Congresswoman Lee Stefanik to the job.
The reversal marks a setback for President Trump, who named Lee Stefanik to be his administration's UN ambassador days after he was elected in November 2024. Stefanik marked one of the administration's more popular nominees for Senate Republicans and even some Senate Democrats who met with her through a flurry of early meetings. However, her nomination remained on ice. And now Trump says he doesn't want to take a chance on a special election to replace Stefanik. House Speaker Mike Johnson would face just a one-member majority if Stefanik had resigned for Republicans to pass much of their agenda. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
A lot can happen in 30 years, but the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office thinks slower expansion of the U.S. population, coupled with ever-rising government spending, is essentially a recipe for stagnant economic growth. CBO outlines in its latest report. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 155 points. This is NPR. Attorney General Pam Bondi is hailing the arrest of an alleged leader of the MS-13 crime gang. Bondi says the 24-year-old man from El Salvador, described as one of the gang's top three leaders, was arrested in Virginia. Bondi says the arrest of the man, identified as Henry Josue Villatero Santos, represents a major victory for the Trump administration as it seeks to crack down on the gang known for brutal violence and extortion. Agents reportedly found several firearms in his home, and he's currently being held on weapons and immigration charges. It was 6 months ago today, Hurricane Helene devastated western North Carolina, the storm the deadliest and costliest ever to hit that state. As Blue Ridge Public Radio's Gerard Albert III tells us, hundreds are having to evacuate again, this time from wildfires.
Along with high winds and dry weather conditions, storm-downed trees and washed-out roads are making the fires harder to fight. E.J. Dwiggins is with the Forest Service.
Polk County is just seen disaster after disaster, and ever since Helene, folks around here are a bit tired of the disasters.
Some 10,000 acres have burned since last week. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein visited with officials from the Forest Service.
What we cannot have happen is the pain, the suffering that the people of Western North Carolina experienced from Hurricane Helene be compounded by a summer of fires.
The governor says he plans to return to Raleigh and ask state legislators for more money to fight wildfires. For NPR News, I'm Gerard Albert III in Asheville.
And I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump has opened up a new front in his trade war. Starting next week, Trump plans to impose a 25% tax on all imported cars and car parts. That's expected to push new car prices up, even as the value of automaker stock is falling. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to talk about the economic ripple effects of the president's new tariffs. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Scott, the president described domestic car makers as thrilled about these new auto tariffs, but their investors, they don't look so happy. What's going on here?
Yeah, most auto stocks were down today. General Motors shares dropped more than 7%. Investors are nervous because even the Detroit automakers import some of their cars and a lot of their parts, so they're going to get hit with these tariffs. Tesla is an exception. The electric car maker relies less on imported parts, so its stock is up today. But President Trump wants all the car makers to build more of their vehicles here in the United States.
This will continue to spur growth like you haven't seen. Before I was elected, we were losing all of our plants that were being built in Mexico and Canada and other places. Now those plants largely have stopped and they're moving them to our country.
Unionized auto workers cheered the president's move. They're hopeful more cars and parts will be built in the U.S. But, you know, it's not entirely clear that's really going to happen. The White House is also counting on these tariffs to raise about $100 billion a year for the government. And the only way that happens is if most of the manufacturing stays where it is. If production really were to shift to the U.S., then that tariff revenue would go down.
Okay, Scott, what if you're a person who's in the market for a new car right now? What does this mean for them?
Well, if you're thinking about buying a new car soon, you might want to get out and do it this weekend before the tariffs take effect. Inflation over the last few years has already pushed the average price of a new car up to about $47,000. Add a 25% tax on top of that, and the sticker price goes up nearly $12,000 more. Now, obviously, car manufacturers might absorb some of that tariff expense, but Jessica Caldwell of the Car Shopping Guide Edmund says this tariff is sure to push today's already high car prices even higher.
It feels just like another blow to like an average middle-income person that had been struggling to buy a car before. And it's not like eggs where we can complain about it, but we can still afford it. I mean, this becomes just not affordable for people to even try to buy because it's such a large purchase.
As a result, more people have to buy used cars, which will then push those prices up. And don't think you can avoid these price hikes just by buying an American-made car. We've seen with Trump's other tariffs, when the import prices go up, even the domestic producers raise their prices to match.
How are other countries responding to these tariffs?
It's a mix of both anger and some hope that perhaps an accommodation can be reached. You know, the tariffs don't take effect until next week, so there is some time for the White House to back down, and that has happened before. But Trump insists these tariffs are permanent. way back in the 1960s, the U.S. slapped a 25% tax on imported pickup trucks. That was supposed to be a short-term response to Germany's tax on imported chicken. We're still living with that pickup truck tax half a century later. It's a big reason that domestic automakers are so focused on pickups. Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says once tariffs like this are in place, they're awfully hard to get rid of.
Tariffs are like a hotel that you check into. It's very hard to check out of if it turns out to be a terrible and unsafe hotel.
President Trump's also threatening more tariffs on imported lumber and pharmaceuticals and other products. So all this could ratchet up.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
The war in Ukraine is now largely being fought with drones, and Ukraine is at the cutting edge of drone innovation. Last year, Ukraine churned out some 2 million UAVs, or unmanned aerial vehicles. The UAVs are both large and small, from high-tech factories to mom-and-pop drone-making operations. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
In a courtyard surrounded by apartment blocks in Kyiv, we walk down some stairs to a tiny basement flat.
Dobry ranok. Andrei, Eleonor.
Oh, hello. There's three big dogs who live here. All around are tables full of drone parts and tools and tweezers and pliers. So these are the drone dogs.
Yeah. It's protected drones. It's our security.
That's Andriy Yukhno, who supervises this FPV, that's first-person view, attack drone-making operation. The windows are covered with paper, but cracked open. We hear children playing.
You have a playground here?
Дитячий садок.
Kindergarten. You're making drones right outside of a kindergarten.
Yeah, but we don't show our drones for children.
Yukhno says he got into drone making because he felt he just had to do something when the war started.
We started with the delivery in Kyiv, food, medicine, what people need. And we start with this, and bigger.
He used to be a barista. Everyone here seems to have had another existence before the full-scale invasion.
I'm super new here. I'm still training.
30-year-old Christina Pashenko recently left her job helping companies appear higher in internet searches because she said she wanted to do something that mattered. Now she's soldering wires to a circuit board. A thin wisp of smoke rises from her soldering wand.
Now I feel super excited and a little bit proud of myself even, that I can do something useful.
Pashenko says the videos of thanks from soldiers on the front lines using their drones are hugely motivating. The commander of Ukraine's ground forces says drones struck and destroyed 22% more Russian targets in February than January, with first-person view drones leading the way. One of Ukraine's most successful drone makers, Vuri, recently celebrated its first 1,100% Ukrainian-sourced drones with a media event. CEO Oleksiy Babenko says it's important to be self-sufficient.
From the start of this war, every time when Ukraine needs something, we need to ask it a lot of time. So only one way how we can stay strong, it's only all that we make in Ukraine. So it's only Ukrainian soldiers, it's only Ukrainian manufacturers.
Russia is a couple months behind Ukraine in drone innovation, but has much bigger production capacity, says Oleksandr Kamyshin, advisor to President Zelensky on strategic affairs. He calls it a technological race.
Once you've got a technology, other side tries to counter this technology, and then you have to find another solution, and then the another side tries to counter it. It's a constant war of innovations and war of technologies.
Back in the basement drone shop, the dogs open their eyes wide, uneasy, as the team tests a drone in a metal cylindrical frame in the center of the room that allows it to fly, twist, and flip. 37-year-old Sasha Potashnik was a dancer before the full-scale invasion. He says he's making drones to help end this war on the best terms Ukraine can get.
We've got to be more realistic. Of course I'd like to get all of our land back, but from the beginning we exaggerated our capacity and we are fighting a very big enemy. We must be sober.
Most sobering, says Potashnik, is that Ukraine's biggest ally, the U.S., may be abandoning his country.
Originally I'm a scientist.
Part-time drone maker Oleh Halaidich has just sat down at his workstation. This scientist with a doctorate in the study of stem cells says making drones is probably the quickest, most impactful way of helping Ukraine.
I think many of people who are like come from art, culture, science, they feel that this is a time of some different decisions.
Science is slow, he says, and we need to do something to protect ourselves right now. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
Wildfires are burning south of Asheville in an area that was hit by catastrophic flooding 6 months ago today. It's a blow to communities still recovering. Throughout southern Appalachia, small towns are having a tough time getting back to normal. Paul Garber from member station WFDD visited the mountain community of Lansing near Boone, North Carolina, where too many bridges are still out.
The waters breached the banks of Buffalo Creek near Mae Medley's house the morning of September 27th. As the flood got closer, she thought about making a run for it, but that would mean leaving behind her husband, John, who has a disability.
If it had kept raining, we'd have just went down the creek with it. John can't walk out of here, and I'm not leaving him. That's exactly what I want to see it.
So they rode it out, together. A half hour after making that fateful decision, it stopped raining. The Medleys survived the flood, but the bridge they used to cross the creek to get to the main road was destroyed. And they weren't alone. State officials say about 8,000 private bridges and roads were washed out by the floods. Replacing so many bridges has become a hardship. Stephen Howe says many residents couldn't use their cars.
I've seen people hitchhiking and try to get a ride to town and go get groceries, and that's affected a lot of people.
Howe is a volunteer for Lansing's Bridge to Recovery. The local nonprofit helps people make repairs in the area. Howe's crew fixed Mae Medley's bridge.
God sent an angel when he came, didn't he?
Private bridges are everywhere in these parts. Most homes on the mountains cross a creek, culvert, or waterway at some point. Upkeep and repair are up to the landowners. Mac Powell is mayor of Lansing. With many bridges still out, he says people here are struggling.
We talk about moving from disaster to recovery, and I know that's supposed to be kind of a natural process, but for a lot of people, this is still disaster.
There are state dollars available to help fix private bridges. But Powell says one barrier to recovery may be that mountain folks are proud to be self-reliant and don't want to ask for help.
People in this area are used to giving. They're much more used to giving than receiving. And that's been a difficult thing for a lot of us.
Bridge to Recovery, the nonprofit, says only one in five of the town's 250 damaged bridges have been fixed so far. For NPR News, I'm Paul Garber in Lansing, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump has withdrawn his nomination for U.S. Representative Elise Stefanik to be ambassador to the United Nations. Trump said he wanted Stefanik to remain in Congress, where Republicans have only a slim majority. Joining us now to discuss this surprise move is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Domenico, what did President Trump have to say about why he made this decision?
Well, he said he wanted to, quote, maintain every Republican seat in Congress, end quote, to help deliver on his agenda. Republicans currently hold 218 seats, Democrats 213. Four seats are currently vacant. That means right now Republicans only have a two-seat majority in the House. And we know that even within the GOP conference, it's not always easy for leadership to keep everyone on the same page, so they need every vote that they can get. Stefanik was one of the first people Trump selected for his administration. Remember, you know, she was also thought to be on the short list for vice president too. So Trump likes her a lot, says that maybe she'll be in his administration at some point. Her nomination was expected to sail through the Senate, but she hasn't been confirmed yet. And apparently Trump, as he himself wrote, appears to be concerned that there was at least some degree of concern of retaining the seat in the House.
Okay, so just to understand, is the thinking here that a Democrat could possibly pick up the seat if she were to leave?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that a Democrat would have won, definitely. You know, this is a pretty Republican seat, upstate New York. And Stefanik won it in November with 62% of the vote. But these special elections can be real wild cards. You know, the out party often has the energy on their side. And this is a reflection of Trump's administration facing political headwinds rather than having the wind at their backs. You know, it's really the first tangible example we've seen showing the White House concerned even a little bit about the politics of Trump's and Republicans' broad agenda. The bottom line here in this seat, though, is that Republicans were still favored to win, but Republicans apparently thought that they might have to sweat it out more than they would have liked, and they're already dealing with a House race in Florida for another open seat happening on Tuesday caused by another Trump appointment, someone else who's been in the news this week, Mike Waltz, who's Trump's national security advisor, who had been caught up in this Signal chat group controversy. The Republican replacement for Waltz's seat there is heavily favored, but national Republicans have also had to intervene because of a lackluster fundraising.
Right. Well, I mean, Domenico, this is a bit of a surprise. What reaction have we heard so far to this news?
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson praised Stefanik and said she would make a great ambassador, but also referenced the Republicans' razor-thin majority and said having her in Congress would help them solidify their majority to get Trump's agenda passed, and offered her a leadership spot, though it's not clear what position that would be because they're currently all filled. Democrats, of course, pouring some salt in the wound. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries boasted that this is evidence Republicans are, quote, afraid of losing her seat because of an unpopular GOP agenda. We know that Americans are concerned about the state of the economy, even though fixing inflation was a key part of Trump's platform in the presidential election. You know, tariff threats could have real consequences for prices for consumers. And consumer confidence we've seen just this week at record lows. So, you know, that could be an issue for Republicans going forward. But Trump's immigration agenda, on the other hand, you know, does seem to be more popular.
You mentioned the economy as well as immigration there. What else is President Trump hoping to accomplish with Congress?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that Trump wants to get done and needs Congress to get done. You know, another sweeping round of tax cuts, for example, funding for deportations and border security. But so far, we haven't seen Congress do a whole lot in trying to get a Trump agenda passed. It's been all by executive action that Trump has done anything in these 2 months, even though it's been a lot. But you can't do everything by executive order alone because those things don't have the force of law. It's really a reflection and a reminder of how important Congress is in solidifying a permanent agenda for a president. You know, as one Republican pollster told me this week, things that are done by pen and phone can be undone by pen and phone.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Ramadan is a time when many Muslim families gather together. But when the fires in Los Angeles destroyed the only mosque in the Altadena area, it almost upended the community's ability to uphold tradition. Well, as the community prepares to celebrate the end of the holy month of Ramadan this weekend, they're finding ways to give the kids and the adults some sense of normalcy. From member station KCRW, Megan Jamerson reports.
Darina Abdus-Samad stands between two long lunch tables of kids ranging from age 2 to 14. They are using a school's outdoor cafeteria for their mosque's iftar, the meal eaten at dusk to break fast during Ramadan.
First of all, I want you to think of at least one good thing that you've done to help your parents.
Kids aren't required to fast from dawn to dusk until they hit puberty, but they attend iftars and are encouraged by their elders to do good deeds.
I took 3 bags of trash out.
High five. What else? Yes.
I helped my mom clean the mess.
These kids are part of the mosque called Masjid al-Taqwa. It was founded over 40 years ago by Black Muslims. Now, it's well known for being a multicultural congregation that varies between 50 to 200 people. In a normal year during Ramadan, they hold nightly community iftars at their mosque. But with their spiritual home destroyed, they've been using the facilities at a local school.
When we eat, we say Bismillah. When we're done, we say Alhamdulillah.
Throughout the evening, little bursts of joy, like this song, were intermingled with the reality that this community is still trying to heal. The Eaton fire wasn't just devastating because they lost their mosque. 4 local families can't return home because it's not safe, and another 8 lost everything, including Dolores Abdus-Shakur. Her family was part of the group that founded this mosque, and now her family's home and their business are also gone.
It's almost like a feeling, it's almost unreal, because life goes on. It just continues to go on.
Tonight, Abdus-Shakur is one of the adults helping prepare the mosque's children for Eid al-Fitr, the holiday that marks the end of Ramadan. She says this is a much-needed positive distraction. Every year, she takes donations from the congregation to buy each child one gift. Despite all the losses faced by this community, enough money was donated to continue the tradition.
This has been a blessing. I would love to be able to go home. I would love to be able to go to our masjid and have our community all together in the masjid. But the reality of it is, that's just not how it is.
The community is doing their best to observe Ramadan like they normally would. Every year, the kids paint a mural for the Eid party and decorate paper bags for Eid gifts. Right now, the kids are writing down their gift wish lists. Abdus-Shakur says it brings her joy to see what they ask for. So she takes a peek over their shoulders.
If you put skinny jeans, you have to say what size. But I have to check with your mom first.
The Eid celebrations and gifts that come this year are a little heavier. But being together in community during Ramadan is helping the adults and kids cope with the traumatic experience of the fires, says mom of 3, Rania Copeland.
My kids are very scarred by the experience. Whenever there's high winds or there's something about a fire, they're very scared.
She says her 11-year-old son was worried they couldn't have Ramadan or Eid because the mosque was gone. She says the tragic loss has given her kids a chance to learn an important lesson about their spirituality.
They're seeing that it's not just about the kind of physical location, but it really is about the community. It's kind of about your spirit and your heart, and that can go anywhere with you.
After Masjid al-Taqwa's Eid celebration, they'll be looking for their next temporary home to hold weekly Friday prayers. And then they'll be focused on rebuilding a permanent home for their mosque. For NPR News, I'm Megan Jamerson in Altadena, California.
This is NPR News.
President Trump announced new tariffs this week and is expected to announce more next week. What does it mean for people in China who make so many American consumer goods? I'm Steve Inskeep. We visit the source of a lot of your stuff on the next morning edition from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Countries have long debated whether to allow deep sea mining for minerals.
One company could move ahead before rules are in place.
Ecosystems will be deeply harmed. Species that we don't even know will be eliminated because we don't even know what's down there.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Florida Republican Congresswoman Anna Paulina Luna is forcing a vote to change House rules so that new parents can vote remotely. NPR's Deidre Walsh tells us she's clashing with her own party leaders who are warning GOP lawmakers not to support the change.
Representative Luna, who had a baby in 2023, pressed House leaders to allow proxy voting for new moms. When they refused, she worked with Democrats to force a vote to update the House's rules. She says it's time to modernize Congress for lawmakers with young families.
What if I get pregnant? Is it going to be a problem that we're not here? I mean, my goodness, the oldest Congress in U.S. history, this will be better for the institution in the long term. And I think many of my colleagues agree with me.
Luna and Colorado Democratic Congresswoman Brittany Patterson's bill provides up to 12 weeks of proxy voting for new parents around the birth of a child. House Speaker Mike Johnson argues remote voting is unconstitutional. The House could vote as soon as next week. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
More than 200 Democratic lawmakers calling on the Trump administration to reinstate two members of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. NPR's Andrea Hsu has the story.
The Democratic lawmakers called the firings an unlawful abuse of presidential power that harms workers. They note over the last decade, the EEOC recovered more than $5 billion for workers subjected to discrimination on the job. Their call comes just over a week after the commission's acting chair issued new guidance warning employers that their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies may be discriminatory under certain circumstances. The fired commissioners have objected to that guidance, saying no one commissioner has the authority to unilaterally change the agency's longstanding position on DEI efforts. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This is NPR. Could a lightning strike have created life on Earth? NPR's Regina Barber reports on how researchers at Stanford University might be giving this old question some new energy.
In 1953, scientists Stanley Miller and Harold Urey filled a glass bulb with methane, water vapor, ammonia, and other atmospheric gases, and then zapped those gases with an electric spark. This reaction created amino acids, the chemical building blocks of life. That experiment made some scientists wonder if a bigger spark, like lightning, could have started life on Earth. But lightning is rare, which is why other researchers favor different starting points, like hydrothermal vents or an asteroid enriched with organic material. But now a study in the journal Science Advances may have found a more common source of electricity called microlightning. These tiny sparks are produced when water droplets separate and get oppositely charged. Microlightning may occur all over nature, giving an old hypothesis new life. Regina Barber, NPR News.
Well, car makers and consumers could soon face higher costs and lower sales as President Trump places 25% tariffs on imported cars and trucks next week. The permanent tariffs could put a financial squeeze on U.S. automakers that depend on global supply chains. That means they could face higher costs and weaker sales that analysts say will be passed on to consumers. The White House says the move will boost domestic manufacturing. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. The federal student loan system is a mess right now. 8 million borrowers are in limbo, waiting for the courts to decide if their repayment plan is legal. And many of the borrowers who aren't in limbo and who should be making monthly payments are not. All while the office that oversees the student loan program has had its staff cut by half. NPR's Corey Turner is here in the studio to help us unpack all of this. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
Okay, Corey, a lot to talk about here, but let's just start with those borrowers who are sort of in limbo, waiting for the courts. What's the latest there?
Yeah, these are the folks who enrolled in President Biden's Saving on a Valuable Education plan. It's called SAVE. The terms of the plan are so generous, Republicans sued. The case is now in the Eighth Circuit, where a federal judge called for a pause on the whole thing. And these 8 million borrowers, while they're not required to make payments right now, they're kind of stuck. A court freeze also shut down enrollment for the past month in all repayment plans that really flex with a borrower's income. And that got ugly when some borrowers suddenly saw their monthly payments inexplicably skyrocket. Yesterday, though, one bit of good news, the Education Department reopened enrollment in those other more affordable plans.
Okay, so what happens if the courts kill the SAVE plan?
Yeah, so that is not entirely clear. Borrowers could be put into a different income-driven plan that was around before SAVE, or maybe some new plan. But whatever the plan, it likely will not be as generous as SAVE, which means borrowers could eventually see their monthly payments increase. It's also worth saying at this point, Juana, that SAVE is in real trouble. Here's Jason Delisle at the Urban Institute.
I mean, there isn't going to be a SAVE plan. That's either going down under legislation or going to go down by the judge's ruling.
Yeah, so Delisle told me if the courts don't strike it down, congressional Republicans are planning to kill SAVE in the big reconciliation bill they're working on right now because, Juana, they can use the savings from killing SAVE to help pay for the extension of the Trump tax cuts.
Got it. Well, here's another question. We said in the intro that there are a whole lot of borrowers who should be making payments right now, and they are not. Tell us why.
Yeah, so NPR obtained internal Education Department data that shows as of earlier this month, 9 million borrowers were late on their payments. And more than 4 million of those were between 91 and 150 days late. The reasons are complicated. When the pandemic paused student loan payments, you remember defaults also stopped. So there were no consequences to not paying your student loans. But many borrowers don't realize those days are over. Last October, the default clock started ticking again. And here's what borrowers need to know. So after 90 days without a payment, your credit takes a big hit. And after 270 days, the government can start going after your paycheck, your tax refund, Social Security. And keep in mind, the federal office in charge of managing all of this $1.6 trillion student loan portfolio just had its staff cut in half. And multiple experts told me borrowers are going to have an even harder time getting their questions answered. Here's Michelle Zampini with the Institute for College Access and Success.
There is no possible way for this to function properly. For borrowers to receive repayment assistance or work help from servicers. I mean, that's so far gone.
Okay, and all of that that you've been talking about, that's all happening as President Trump announced last week that he was moving student loans out of the Education Department immediately. What's the latest there, Corey?
Right, he said student loans would be moving to the U.S. Small Business Administration and that they were ready. The problem there is twofold. On the same day of that announcement, the SBA also said it was cutting its own staff by more than 40%. So it is not clear how it could be any better positioned to manage a loan portfolio with 43 million borrowers. The other problem here is the loan program being at the Education Department is baked into federal law, which only Congress can change. I asked for clarity. The Small Business Administration sent me a statement saying the SBA is working closely with the White House, Department of Education, and Congress to finalize this plan. And I think one of the and Congress there is really key because If that happens, Democrats would almost certainly be able to block a move like this.
NPR's Corey Turner, thank you.
You're welcome.
The U.S. women's rugby team made waves last summer when they won their first Olympic medal. This spring, players and fans hope to build on that momentum with the inaugural season of U.S. pro women's rugby. WBUR's Maddie Browning checked out a practice session with Boston's new team.
The Boston Banshees take over a turf field for late night practice. Their coach eyes players as they complete drills. It's only a week before their first professional game. Players assemble into a scrum. They lock arms and push against the other team to claim possession of the ball. Rugby is like a mix of American football and soccer. It's an aggressive contact sport with limited padding. 33-year-old player Katie Benson returned to the States to join the Banshees after playing pro in Manchester, England. She's excited to finally play closer to home.
I think it's absolutely amazing to have the sport at this level and people get to see us play. It's just really exciting, and it's like a really exciting time to like grow in women's rugby.
The Boston Banshees are one of six teams across the country in women's elite rugby. Only 4 weeks into training, Coach Kittery Ruiz says Boston is already embracing its new team.
There's a huge rugby community in Boston in general. There's multiple men's teams, multiple women's teams, high school teams, college teams. And so that fan base is sort of already set in place because they are rugby fans, they're rugby people.
Ruiz used to coach one of Boston's amateur women's rugby teams. She says it's crucial for a league like this to have consistent, competitive games.
Success for me is, you know, a successful, good showing where we have a good platform to build on in the future years. It's, you know, good, fast-paced, hard-hitting rugby that brings fans in that have never seen rugby before, that want to learn what it's about.
Jackie Finland started a publication called The Rugby Breakdown. She says fans have to band together to support teams in person.
We got to organize carpools. We have to do this big shift to get out there and physically represent in the stadiums. But I think, yeah, if you see people making an effort, that will be a win for year one.
Women's Elite Rugby co-founder Catherine Aversano says this season's games will be played in stadiums of between 1,500 to 5,000 seats. The league saw how beneficial free streaming was for the WNBA. They will be following in their footsteps this year by streaming every match.
The reality is we could have waited a couple years to do this, but by then, if we really want to develop a high quality level of rugby in the United States that ends up being showcased for the World Cup, we need to get started now.
28-year-old player Emma Santasuaso says it's a relief to be paid to play on the team.
Coming from a semi-professional league where we paid for all of our travel, we paid to play on the team, and just like doing all the admin stuff, being able to just play rugby and also not have to pay to play rugby and get to travel across the country with your team, it's really exciting.
Aversano says the league realizes it could take a couple years to turn a profit, and they are ready for that. For NPR News, I'm Maddie Browning in Boston.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Millions of people use StubHub to buy tickets for games and concerts. And if you can't make the event, StubHub says no sweat. You can sell your ticket too at any time. Turns out there is a catch, and it is infuriating users. NPR's Raphael Naum has the story.
When Susan Burke found out Beyoncé was playing a concert near Washington, D.C., she was beyond excited. She's a big fan. And she especially loves Beyoncé's latest album, Cowboy Carter.
I think it's really special and transformative, so I'm like especially excited to get to see this album performed live.
So Burke went on StubHub and bought three tickets for herself and her two friends. But then she found better seats, front row of the section. Easy, she thought. She'll buy those and sell her old ones.
And I thought, well, StubHub says that it's easy to relist tickets, so I'll just do that. It'll be no issue.
So she listed her tickets, and that's when she realized something weird. When she went to check on them, she couldn't find them anywhere. That's how she discovered StubHub has a filter called Recommended Tickets that only displays some tickets at a time. It's on by default. You can turn it off if you know where to look for it. And Burke thought, hang on, why?
It's like you'd think you'd want the most options, but I guess their algorithm or something decides that they don't want to show everyone.
Burke is not the only seller confused about this filter. NPR talked to over half a dozen sellers, sellers like Jamie Dawson McDowell in Indiana. Dawson McDowell is a frequent buyer and seller on StubHub. But one day, he also realized he could not find the tickets he had just listed.
I recall sort of like freaking out a little bit, thinking, what did I do wrong? And then I stumbled upon the filter and the fact that the recommended tickets toggle switch is always on by default. And I thought, well, this is a little crazy.
He still can't figure out why StubHub recommends some of his tickets, but not others. Is it the price? The seat? And if he got confused, what about casual buyers? He saw this firsthand when Taylor Swift came to Indiana last year.
There were lots of people I knew who were trying to find tickets who didn't use StubHub nearly as often as I did and were unknowingly not looking at the whole picture. They're looking at just a fraction of the tickets that were on there.
There's a reason for that. According to StubHub, the company told NPR it introduced the recommended tickets filter in late 2022. So now StubHub only shows what it says are the lowest price tickets and also the best tickets by section. That means buyers will only see some of the tickets. Dawson McDowell thinks that's not fair.
I mean, it's just supposed to be a marketplace for you to sell your tickets.
And he wonders, shouldn't that be up to the sellers?
It does make you wonder what the motivation is. I'm not certain what that would be, because if you're StubHub, I would think selling a ticket is selling a ticket.
That's what Susan Burke thought too. But StubHub told her she should just lower her ticket prices. She's not keen to do that, at least not yet. Not until she gives her tickets a chance to sell.
I'm definitely very frustrated about it because I just want my tickets to have the opportunity to be bought.
Because her tickets are there in StubHub. They're just not easy to find. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. We've talked a lot about critical minerals lately, like there's a global scramble for metals such as cobalt and nickel that are used in technology like electric car batteries. And one place with a lot of these minerals is the ocean floor. Nobody has done deep sea mining on a commercial scale, and countries have been arguing for years over rules that would govern mining in international waters. Now, one company has announced plans to move ahead even before rules are in place. Reporter Daniel Ackerman joins us now from Kingston, Jamaica. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so explain what this announcement means.
Yeah, so this is an announcement by The Metals Company. It's a startup based in Canada, and they want to mine the seabed in the Eastern Pacific Ocean. It's a region they say holds enough nickel and cobalt to supply 280 million electric cars.
Wow.
Now, that's about the size of the entire U.S. passenger vehicle fleet.
Wow.
And the metals company has developed and tested a whole deep sea mining system for this. It's kind of like a giant vacuum cleaner that would hoover up these metal bearing rocks from the seabed. And just this afternoon, the company said it will seek permission from the U.S. government in the coming months to start the mining process. But that's not really how the process is supposed to work.
Wait, how is the process supposed to work?
So countries have been working together for more than a decade to draw up regulations for deep sea mining. And I'm actually here in Jamaica right now covering negotiations on those regulations. And these rules, they cover major issues like who gets paid, how do we protect this part of the environment that belongs to all of us? You know, this is international waters. And these negotiations are happening under the International Seabed Authority. This is a group that has been tasked by the United Nations with regulating about a third of the Earth's surface, which is this seafloor that's beyond the control of any one country, roughly beneath international waters. And the Seabed Authority includes the vast majority of the world's countries, but notably not the United States.
Okay, well, you said these talks, they've been going on for more than a decade, but demand for these metals is pretty high right now, and I guess it seems like the metals company has gotten impatient with this whole international process, or what?
Yeah, that seems right. The company had said it would work with the International Seabed Authority, but today's announcement indicates perhaps they just intend to partner with the U.S. government and basically go it alone. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to CEO Jared Barron just before this meeting, he hinted at this possibility, and he said, you know, the industry could no longer wait on this international rulemaking process.
The best way to protect the marine environment is to regulate it, and let's see whether they do. But one way or another, this resource is going to be developed.
So he kind of gave negotiators almost an ultimatum there.
Wow. Well, what are the countries attending these talks saying about all this?
Well, I'm hearing some condemnation from delegates and other observers here at these talks. They're worried that unregulated mining could damage ocean health. I have not heard any word from the U.S. government about this yet. But, you know, the metals company CEO has emphasized to me that the U.S. hasn't joined the Seabed Authority. It's not bound by international law here. And, you know, the Trump administration wants to source minerals from places other than China. And some Trump officials have voiced support for seabed mining.
That is reporter Daniel Ackerman in Kingston, Jamaica. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Elsa.
Renowned conductor Michael Tilson Thomas is leading some of his final concerts. MTT, as he's long been known, has been battling brain cancer for the last 4 years. His cancer returned earlier this year. NPR's Greg Allen reports one of his last concerts will be at the Orchestral Academy he helped found in Miami Beach, the New World Symphony.
For more than three decades, the New World Symphony has been a home for young musicians, helping them prepare for professional careers. MTT wasn't available for an interview, but his friends and colleagues had a lot to say about him and the institution he built in Miami Beach.
You can't go to an American orchestra concert without hearing a New World alum.
Howard Herring has worked alongside Michael Tilson Thomas as New World's CEO for more than 20 years. During that time, the New World Symphony has grown from an upstart into an important cultural institution with an innovative concert hall that was designed by architect Frank Gehry.
It's hard to know where to go start.
Okay. Herring says from the front doors to the stage, the concert hall reflects MTT's ideas about music and its connection to the community. Almost since the beginning, video has been an integral part of each New World Symphony concert. Video is projected inside the hall and on the building's exterior, where audiences can watch and hear the live performance. In the hall, the performers are surrounded by the audience, and they sit very close to the stage. MTT grew up in a theatrical family, and Herring says his ideas about performance reflect that.
It was Michael's theatrical impulse, his understanding of what could happen as a result of the music itself and building theater around it and building video around it that led us to this place.
Putting the audience so close to the performers took some getting used to. A few years after the new concert hall opened, MTT stopped a concert at one point and asked a mother with a fidgeting child seated behind the stage to leave the hall. Since then, the performers and audience members have adjusted, Herring says.
We are all comfortable sitting close to each other. In the early days, we had our moments.
More than the concert hall, Michael Tilson Thomas's legacy at New World is in the generations of young musicians he's helped train, nurture, and counsel. Vishnu Ramankuti is a viola player in his first year at New World. He first met MTT and played in his orchestra when he was a high school student and saw then the personal interest he took in young musicians.
If someone was, say, for instance, practicing, you know, late at night, and MTT was just around, MTT was known as being the sort of individual that, you know, he would knock on the door and he'd be like, hey, what are you practicing? What's up? Do you need any help?
Michael Linville has known and worked with MTT for more than 30 years, since he first entered New World as a piano fellow. He's been there ever since as a staff member, now a dean. Linville says the news that MTT's cancer had returned and he was ending his professional career was a blow.
When I think about it, it still is a shock. It's also a miracle that Michael has survived this cancer and, you know, is still getting up on stage and performing. It's quite miraculous.
MTT's last performances as conductor are scheduled this weekend in Miami and next month at his other longtime home, the San Francisco Symphony. Here in Miami, the final program will include Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. He was also on the program in the first concert he conducted with New World 37 years ago. Linville says for MTT, the music, composed during a time of political upheaval in Europe, is deeply personal.
All of the tumult and the, you know, the unstable nature of the way things were going in Europe then, and the ultimate optimism about what the future might hold.
Linville says Beethoven's Fifth offers a message of hope. Michael Tilson Thomas believes it's especially relevant today. This weekend's concerts in Miami Beach will be celebratory and somber. But as Linville says, Michael's a showman, and he'll put on a great show. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami Beach.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach, starts Friday in theaters. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend, at easycater.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and Kathy.
Things okay.
Just whistle and blow your blues away. You'll swing them all through the day. And whistle and blow your blues away.